Welcome back to Alive at 5. I'm your host, David Leonard, and it's my pleasure to spend some time on the phone today with Colleen Cowles. Colleen is the author of a book entitled War on Us, How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on All of Us. I wanted her to come on the program and spend some time with me here today discussing her book, discussing the war on drugs and the issues surrounding it, and why it is, I think anybody that looks at the situation here in the United States with problems we're having with methamphetamine and the opioid crisis, I don't think anybody would disagree when I say that it's a real mess. But I do think that there's probably some things we can do to begin working our way out of it. And we're going to spend some time with Colleen discussing those here today. Right at the top, Colleen, thank you so much for making some time for me.
Thanks for having me. It's great to talk about this topic, one that is beginning to affect everyone.
No doubt about that. Here at the beginning, for a listener out there that may not be familiar with you, let's begin with this then. Tell us about yourself. Who is Colleen Cowles?
Well, I grew up on a potato farm in Wisconsin. I'm an estate planning attorney by trade, and 15 years ago, we were a typical family, married children, and ended up with sons who developed substance use disorders. So this is not a topic that I had ever envisioned gaining expertise in, but 15 years ago, when we started being impacted personally, there's a lot of information out there, but it was very difficult to know really what to do. So I started researching, and 15 years later, here I am. But what ended up happening was I was so shocked when I started researching. I thought as an attorney that I had an idea of a little bit about drug policy, the reasons for it, how it was applied and why. And the more I researched, the more I realized how not only weren't we doing the right things, but what we were doing was creating more of a disaster. We were doing almost the opposite of the right things. And now we've gotten to the point where I'm seeing drug policy not only impacting people with substance use disorders, but impacting the lives of everyone, including our health care, our assets, our freedom, our safety, our families. So it's become a broader topic and one that I just felt like I couldn't not speak about after the research that I did.
You mentioned that this really began for you in a very personal way when you had children who had fallen prey to the problems associated with drug addiction. And as you began working with this, one of the things I'm hearing you telling us is that for parents out there in the position that you were in, knowing where to go and how to get help in those situations, it can be extremely difficult to figure that out. Am I getting that right?
You're very right on that, David. One of the challenges is the whole question about whether addiction is a choice, is it a disease, is it a response to the environment, and there's a lot of confusion about that. But even as our government has issued statements acknowledging that it's a health issue, we still treat it as a moral failing, and our whole approach is punitive. And as long as that approach is punitive, it keeps us from looking at it as a medical problem. So one of the most fascinating things and one of the facts that really changed my mind and made me start looking at this differently was when I realized that there are medications right now that have been proven and are acknowledged by all of our government agencies that can cut the risk of overdose in half. And through those medications, there are people who have been struggling with addiction for years who are actually now being able to regain their lives and go back to normal, taxpaying, productive citizens. And yet those medications are denied to people in most jails, most prisons, most people on probation, a lot of the peer support groups, a lot of the treatment centers. So we have medications that can greatly help with addiction, and yet we're not allowed to use them. So if I look at other health issues, if we pick any health issue out there, diabetes, for example, if we treated that the way that we're treating addiction, where if somebody eats a candy bar and they're a diabetic, we throw them in jail. We take away their insulin. We tell the people around them not to support them and that we should let them hit bottom and that if we are supporting them, we're somehow harming them. I mean, we'd have an epidemic of diabetes. You know? So if we treat addiction as a health issue and remove it from the criminal justice system and put it under the province of public health, we would see enormous changes. And people would feel comfortable with stepping up and asking for help.
Well, you are touching on so many different aspects of this particular issue here today, Colleen. I'm having a hard time deciding where to start, but I guess I would begin with this. You know, I turned 60 earlier this year, and so for my entire adult life, I remember when Richard Nixon declared war on drugs when I was a child. Mm-hmm. And so for my entire adult life, I've listened to the government telling us that drugs are bad for you and that they cause a lot of problems for people and that we're going to lock you up if we catch you doing that. And during the course of that time, that roughly 40 years or so, we have seen the use of illegal drugs become more prevalent. We have seen them produced with a wider variety. We have seen the price of them become much cheaper than they used to be, which tells me that the market out there for them is doing extremely well. We've seen all these things rise up in response to this supposed war on drugs that really, one of the things that caught me about your book was the title, The War on, A War on All of Us, because that's a phrase that I've used for many years. I've said, this isn't a war on drugs, it's a war on the United States citizens. So let's start with that. How did we get to this point where things are, I think even the proponents of the drug war will admit that things are a mess right now here in the U.S.
They certainly are. I think part of it is that instinctively we know that when we see the horrors of addiction, substance use disorder can destroy families. It's obviously killing people. And so it's instinctive to think, well, if we just keep drugs away from people, then that's the solution. The challenge is that we've now got a 50-year history of the failed war on drugs. We've spent over $1 trillion. The United States has spent more money, and our results are that we have the highest levels of drug use, we've got the highest addiction rates, and the highest incarceration rates in the world. So it's time to step back and say what felt instinctively right hasn't worked. That approach has obviously not worked. Unfortunately, when we're in pain, I think it's easy to react from fear, and when we do that, we tend to not look at things objectively. I mean, I understand when I'm talking to groups and I'm saying, you know, when I'm talking about the medications that I was referring to earlier, it is a little bit hard to believe that you treat drug issues with drugs. And yet, there are different types of medications and they do work. So we really have to step back and not just react and actually look at the data. We've got places around the world that have different policies that are working. So it's time to step back and really look at the facts and try to keep the emotion out of it, other than the emotional need to move forward and to solve some issues. But one example of reactions and how we're still doing it is the opioid epidemic has gotten more and more publicity, physicians now are really under attack. We're having the DEA controlling the amount of medications that are being produced. It's very likely that we will have a shortages of pain medications that pain patients legitimately need. We're having physicians leaving practices that have to do with either addiction or pain management because they're personally afraid of having DEA raids or being accused of overprescribing. So at a time that we need those physicians the most, we have pain patients being cut off from their medications and not being able to find physicians. And in turn, they're going to the streets and increasing the risk of their own addiction or their own overdose. So often what we do to react to the issues actually escalates the problem.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about this for a moment. Part of the title of your book, you refer to myths about addiction that have certainly had a huge impact on how this war has been prosecuted. So let's begin with that here, Colleen. But when you talk about myths about addiction, what is it you're specifically referring to? What is it that I guess policymakers are getting so wrong about drug addicts?
Well, I think the biggest one is the question of choice. Because if addiction is a choice, then what we've done historically with the war on drugs and threatening and putting them behind bars should have worked. It hasn't. If medications, and it's proven now that medications work for a lot of people, it's not even very likely. We know that there are people that are in prison long term because they didn't get the right health care. So the whole myth about addiction being a choice and not having to do with a health issue is a huge myth. The other myth that if someone tries certain types of drugs, they will be addicted right away, has kind of led to we need to control the supply and keep drugs away from people completely. There is no doubt that taking certain types of drugs, particularly meth, heroin, opioids, is very, very dangerous to certain people and particularly street drugs that are tainted with fentanyl. But it's very important for people to understand that 10 to 20% of people will become addicted. Now, for parents and for children listening to this, it is like Russian roulette trying those drugs, largely because a 10 to 20% addiction rate is huge, but also because one experimental test of street drugs can kill you because of the tainted nature of the drugs. So again, as we have restricted the supply of drugs, we are sending more people to the streets. They're being supplied by the drug cartels, and we're ending up with tainted drugs. So a lot of the issues. And I'm not minimizing the issue with addiction. I mean, it's very personal to me, and it's a horrific problem. But the response to it has been the best possible thing we could have done for the drug cartels and for sending people to street drugs.
I'm visiting this afternoon with Colleen Cowles. Colleen is the author of a book entitled War on Us, How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on All of Us. You know, Colleen, as you're talking about seeing people becoming involved with, say, pain medications and then not being able to get the medications that they require and end up going out on the street to get some relief, you know, you reminded me of a theory that I've had for quite some time about regarding methamphetamine and why it's such a problem in our country today. It seems to me that methamphetamine was not much of a thing in the United States, even though it existed for decades prior to that. And it had been here, but it was pretty much in the province of the biker gangs, the Hells Angels, and those types of organizations back in those days. But in the early 70s, the DEA stepped in and said, okay, doctors, you can't prescribe diet pills to folks any longer. And so all the people out there that were taking Benzedrine and Dexedrine diet pills to lose weight and have more energy, because there's some people that just want to have some zip in their lives, evidently, all of a sudden, I mean, they're not able to go to the doctor and get what they wanted. But that didn't mean that the market for this stuff went away. In fact, if anything, the market for it went underground. And it's in the years following that action by the DEA that we've seen the rise of methamphetamine. And when I relate a story, when I relate that situation to you, what do you say to that? Because I can tell you, I've talked to law enforcement officials about this, and I've told them exactly what I told you, and now no one to this point has disagreed with what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. I speak with a lot of law enforcement officials as well, and many of them are really frustrated with what's going on, and they're in the crossfire here. In fact, police right now, the death rates of police are higher for suicide than on-job deaths at this point. They're in the middle of a very difficult situation, but their jobs depend on carrying out policy that can be very harmful. I mean, there are some areas where the police or the sheriffs have decided that they aren't going to arrest individuals for drug possession. Instead, we're going to help them find treatment, which makes sense, although it would make more sense if we could allow our police to focus on real crime and sort of murders and rapes and that kind of thing that go unsolved while they're dealing with low-level drug possession cases. But it's very difficult for law enforcement. As to your point on why meth has ended up being a larger problem, you're absolutely right. And we are repeating history. We haven't learned a lot going back to alcohol prohibition that didn't work. And, you know, then we started drug prohibition. We're doing the same thing with restricting the opioids now that we did, you know, like you said, as far as the diet pills. Many people on meth are self-medicating attention deficit. The composition of Adderall, which is prescribed for attention deficit, is very similar in composition to meth. The problem is that meth has so many, there's such a problem with meth on the street. And obviously there are problems with people taking those drugs who don't need them. But if we start putting criminal justice professionals and attorneys, judges, prosecutors, in between the patient and the doctor and taking the power away from the doctor, we have a real problem. I mean, I have legal training, and I can tell you that law school did not give me any expertise whatsoever that would qualify me to sit on a bench or in a prosecutor's office and dictate what type of treatment someone should have. And yet that's what's happening. At the same time, we're questioning what doctors are doing. And they're the ones that have the medical expertise and are looking at the one-on-one needs of patients. So it's really kind of a convoluted system that we're dealing with here.
Well, I've had law enforcement officers look me right in the eye and tell me that we're never going to be able to arrest our way out of this problem, quote unquote. I've heard that from several different people, and it's a viewpoint that I share, absolutely. I don't think the criminal justice system is the correct place to be dealing with drug addicts in general, unless they've committed some other sorts of crimes. But just to lock up nonviolent drug offenders, it seems to me that that's quite frankly an immoral public policy. So, Colleen, looking at the situation we're in today, where do we go from here? Let's, because we painted a pretty grim picture. Let's talk about some possible solutions.
About looking at solutions is that the system is so bad right now that some even minor changes can make huge advances. The first thing I always look at is steps to strictly just keep them alive. And there are a lot of ways of doing that. Narcan, which is now a nasal spray, very easy for anyone to use, can bring someone back from an overdose. And that it's easy to use, and it's not harmful. If we could make that an over-the-counter drug, it would make it so much easier. Because right now, for someone to have to go into a pharmacy, a lot of people just don't feel comfortable doing that, again, because of the legal taint and the stigma. We have fentanyl test strips that for $2 can test drugs. And again, that seems counterintuitive. We don't want people doing drugs. Why would we give them, you know, help in testing them? But until we can get them help and get the medical services that we need, $2 could save lives. It would have saved Prince's life. So there are tools that we can use to do that. The biggest thing, though, is to start transferring the whole system from the criminal justice to the public health. And I don't believe, and I've looked at these numbers closely, it doesn't take extra money. Taxpayers would actually save dollars if we transferred the funding and the focus from incarceration and prosecution and probation requirements and all of the huge punitive measures that we're taking now. And if we started looking at this as a health issue that needs to be diagnosed on an individual basis between a doctor and a patient, because so often addiction is accompanied by either physical or mental other health issues. So a full diagnosis, just like we treat any other health issue, would make all the difference in the world. Right now, 1 in 3 American citizens have a criminal record. And those criminal records are minimizing opportunities for life, and it that affects all of us. We have a whole population here whose success is being compromised by a system that's not working.
Would it be fair to say that the approach that you're advocating here today, Colleen, is really revolves around a term I've heard used, harm reduction, which is basically, it's why you hand out free needles to addicts to stop the spread of AIDS, because there is less harm in that than having them infect one another with AIDS, that sort of thing. Is harm reduction, exactly, is that what we should be looking at as a society?
Absolutely, we should be looking at that as a society. And harm reduction is saving lives. But it's not only those who, because there are some people that until they're personally involved, there is that stigma out there. And some people say, hey, we've got a lot of issues in the world. Why should we prioritize the issue of helping people that are addicted to drugs? But the cascade effect is enormous. Addiction leads to approximately 70 other health issues. Because people aren't getting treatment, they're going to ERs when they need help. That makes it more difficult for other people to get proper health care. Drug testing has gotten completely out of hand. We have 150 million drug tests annually, and there's a 5 to 10% false positive rate on those. So there's 7.5 million individuals annually that are falsely accused of using drugs and losing jobs and sometimes ending up behind bars. So the cascade effect on all of this is just enormous. So when we talk about harm reduction, it's not only reducing the harm to those individuals that have substance use disorder, but it's reducing the harm to the whole population.
Well, and certainly it seems to me that this is one of the things I've never been able to understand about the more politically conservative people who ostensibly claim that the fiscal bottom line is what they're always so concerned about. Because when you look at, you pointed out, over $1 trillion we've spent on this. And where have we gotten with that? Only the government would execute a policy like that. No business would even begin to attempt it because they'd go broke. So, you know, it seems to me, though, Colleen, one of the fundamental things we haven't really touched on, and I think we should, is the fact that, well, we've touched on it a little bit, but let's talk about this. One of the things I've said to one of our state lawmakers is we were having a discussion about drug addiction and the drug laws, and she asked me, well, okay, so what do we have to do? Where do we start? And I said, well, I think the first place you have to start is not by stigmatizing drug addicts as criminals, because and it's what you were touching on, because once that happens, you know, then you're a bad person. You know, that's just it. You're a bad person because you're a criminal, because you smoke pot or you snorted some cocaine, whatever it was, used meth. That makes you a bad person. I think the message should really be that these drugs are not healthy for you to be involved in, and they of themselves being addicted to these substances is bad, but that doesn't mean that these people are bad people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think even our language portrays that. We don't call people a cancer, but we call them addicts. The reference to being clean infers that if you're not totally abstinent, somehow that's horrible, and that keeps people from using medical means to treat their health issues. So this really shouldn't be, and I would hope that it's not as information is shared more. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. I mean, if there's any example of why government shouldn't be involved too heavily in healthcare, this is it. So I can argue it on both sides of the aisle as far as conservatives or liberals or any type, any political views. When we look at the results of what we've done, not only in solving the issues, but again in ruining lives and killing people, it's time for everyone to just look at the facts and to take steps to make change here.
Well, I'm going to relate to you another personal anecdote. I had a conversation with a state lawmaker not that long ago regarding the issue we were talking about, drug addiction. And I said to them, I said, well, look, I said, you want to keep drugs out of society. That's what these laws are all ostensibly designed to do. Personally, I don't think that's what they accomplish, but that's what the intent of them is. I said, but it was only a few months prior to that we had a drug bust at Springfield State Penitentiary, where they were arrested with marijuana. So if you can't keep it out of prison, how on earth do you think you're going to be able to keep it out of society in general, society as a whole? To me, there has to be a fundamental rethink of this approach, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Well, and one of the chapters in the book talks about why the war on drugs continues, because most people, when you talk to them, realize that it's not working. So it was hard for me to understand why has it gone on for so long. But it is amazing, like anything that goes on for 50 years, there is huge profit behind it. There's huge businesses. There's lobbying from a lot of different different types of companies. An example of that, when the marijuana legalization statutes were defeated in Arizona, the largest contributor to that political the political movement against the legalization was a pharmaceutical company, who very shortly after that ended up getting FDA approval for a cannabis-based product that they could sell. So I think a lot of times when we're seeing some of the publicity behind the rejection of changing the war on drugs, we really have to look at who's behind it and what the motivations are.
Well, Colleen, I couldn't agree with you more on just about everything that we've touched on here today. And unfortunately, our time has evaporated far too quickly. If we have a listener out there today, though, that would like to be able to take a look at your website to learn more about your work or to be able to get a copy of your book, how can they go about doing that?
The easiest way is the book is on Amazon, but the easiest way to get links, videos, a lot more information is our website, and that is www.waronus.com.
Very good. I want to take a moment now to thank you for spending this time with me here today, for writing the book that you've written, and also for the no-nonsense, straightforward approach that you're taking to this issue. This is it's a very thorny issue for a lot of people. And Colleen, I your candor and frankness here today are very much appreciated by me, so thank you for all that.
Well, thanks for taking an interest in the topic. I really appreciate that.
Colleen Cowles joining me here this afternoon on Alive at 5. Her book, War on Us, How the War on Drugs and Myths About Addiction Have Created a War on All of Us. Keep it tuned right here to Yankton's home team, AM 1450 KYNT, and we'll be right back after this.